Today on Entrepreneurs Worldwide, we are delighted to have a very, very special guest, an award-winning serial entrepreneur.
I went to the then marketing director of British Gas and I said, oh, we can buy this amazing web URL called gas.co.uk. I think we should buy it. It's currently, you know, I can't even remember what it was, £700. We should buy that. And they were like, I don't think so. What? Why would you want that? I mean, now I'm like, I should have just bought it myself.
A farm girl born in New Zealand and arrived here in this country in 1997 with £80 in her pocket and a backpack. This is a girl that arrives in 1997 with £80 in her pocket and a backpack. Mm. And then you sell for multi-millions in 2014. What does that feel like?
I mean, bulletproof.
Were you building businesses with the exit in mind from the beginning?
Yes. I was creating this new platform and, yeah, if I had taken a big salary, I don't think we would have had the money to take the jump to move it from a server-based software to a SaaS-based software.
So
I wouldn't pay myself. And it's
really?
Still, it's still
until
now.
You got, until you hit that, until you sold?
And still now. It's like I'm the last one to eat.
She went on to build a tech company, Sonar, in 2004, sold it to an American corporation in 2014 for a lot of money.
I'd made a lot of money. I'd bought myself a yacht.
How has making multi-millions affected your love life?
Because when you work with somebody that you supposedly love, you can fall out of love with them pretty quickly.
Is that because you're a rebel by nature, or is that because your mind...
I'm definitely a rebel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you ever had therapy?
What type of therapy? I've had marriage counselling, which didn't go very well, of course.
We all have. Terrible.
Yeah, that was a disaster.
We've all had marriage counselling. Yeah. We're all divorced. Oh, yeah. Today on Entrepreneurs Worldwide, we are so delighted to have Tracy Shercliffe here. Thank you so much. And she hasn't been easy to get either,
no,
has she?
No, she has not.
What are your qualifications? Because you're highly qualified as well. You've been to University of Canterbury. Talk me through that.
I've got an undergraduate degree in geology and zoology. I thought at some point I might want to be a paleontologist before I worked out that I'd be stuck in an oil field in the middle of the South Sea somewhere. So I then moved over and I've now got a first-class master's degree in marketing and management.
How does a farm girl end up where you are today?
I mean, the person I've got to label as my dad, who sadly isn't here anymore, but he was definitely the driving force. Think South Island, New Zealand farmer. He was sexist, chauvinistic. I mean, you could tick all the boxes. Girls were supposed to be seen and not heard. The best chance I had was marrying a farmer with two farms, because he said, you're pretty enough for that, Tracy. So I had different plans. And so everything was, no, I'm not going to be that person.
Being a rural girl like that, were you aware that you had this incredible brain inside your head?
Richard, the flattery, I love it. No, I realised I was a little bit different probably than everybody else. I didn't aspire to do what everybody thought that I should.
What about your mother?
My mother, she's very independent actually. She was a city girl from Sydney who ended up in this small town in New Zealand as a raspberry picker. So she was a fruit picker, ended up meeting my dad.
Did he tell you he loved you?
No.
No. It's often the case.
Yeah. Yeah, really struggled with that.
Yeah.
Which I probably struggle with hearing the words love.
Straight,
I know, she's gone straight to the heart.
Sorry.
Straight in.
Haven't missed a beat.
I can see the first short coming out of this podcast already. Did he tell you he loved you?
It's often
great,
the case,
she's straight in.
With that kind of background, those kinds of men, unfortunately, they're never taught how to love. And intimacy is a real problem. And so when you were describing it, I could recognise the man.
But, you know, I'm enormously grateful because now you look back and it's like his absence of love made me seek it to such an extent that I have, you know, the magic that, you know, the absence brings is that you want it so much and the adoration that you push the buttons to get to the place that's like, have you noticed me yet? Have you noticed me yet?
Yeah.
Do you think that's made you a really tough businesswoman?
Almost certainly. Yep. Also, seeing the struggle that farmers go through, because it's that skill that they have to be able to do everything, like literally everything, from, you know, fix a car or a truck to deal with the accounts, to deal with a business problem. And he, I mean, where did I get my entrepreneurial spirit from? 100% him. I mean, he's done more things than I can even imagine. He put a mining quarry and started mining limestone on the farm. Wow. He imported buffalo from Australia, trying to start that as kind of a meat. Mm. He also then started an alluvial gold mine, which is probably why I went into geology.
You didn't just leave your family, you left your country.
You know, it's funny. It probably seems quite extreme to people from England, but there is a thing called the OE. And actually, in New Zealand, we even name it something. We call it the brain drain. Whereas that people go through school and pretty much they go for their, you know, in England, it's a gap year where you go away for a year and you come back. But we do an OE. And the proportion of people who go and come back is, I mean, most people do. And I just never have. So, you know, I am enormously grateful for how good this country has been to me. But by God damn it, I've worked for it.
Yeah. So you arrive here in 1997 with £80 in your pocket and a backpack. Were you going to get a bar job, which is like a lot of students do?
Originally, I wasn't going to stay. But after travelling through Asia for 6 months, I was like, I don't want to go back. This is too exciting. And I got here and I was like, there's got to be some great opportunities. There's certainly got to be bigger opportunities here than there would be in New Zealand.
What was your first break?
Oh, I got a break through a friend. I literally did start with a bar job. I was waitressing, and then I got a break at Colt Telecoms doing fibre optic routing.
Wow.
I was like, I don't even know what that means, but yes.
Sounds good.
Which was basically, well, I mean, it wasn't very sexy. It was basically kind of data points to data points, routing where optic fibres should be connected for phone systems. And there I got the eye of the head of marketing, the marketing director, and he gave me a job kind of in the marketing team.
1997, it was just very, very early days for all this tech.
Yeah. I was one of the first 20,000 people on LinkedIn.
Absolutely.
100%.
Yeah.
So tech was always the thing. So I came out of university with kind of a bend towards marketing. And so that was always the thing. I thought that is where I would go. And so very early on, we saw the shift between, I guess, kind of what happened to the traditional advertising. Mm. And I went, my first real proper job was I worked in direct marketing for British Gas. Mm. And I actually went in and I got a job in Business Gas just as they were going through the deregulation of competition. Nobody else wanted this job, right?
Is this digital marketing, though?
So literally, DM is direct marketing, but direct marketing turned into digital marketing. So I started that there pretty quick after my job at Colt Telecoms. I got a job at British Gas. Nobody really wanted it. It was really unsexy. It's like, but for me, coming from New Zealand, you know, a country of 3 million people at that stage, I was going into a job where they had 19 million customers that they were trying to keep. I mean, that blew my mind. I mean, how could you ever work in marketing and your job is to keep 19 million customers? I was like, how hard can that be? It transpires. It was quite hard because they started off with Business Gas, which was the deregulation of competition, and businesses would just go because it was cheaper. So, you know, I got very quickly asked to run a team and I had the telemarketing team. And Richard, at that time, people were still drinking at lunchtime.
Yeah.
So I was managing this team of telemarketers. There was about 15 of them. And at 12 o'clock at lunchtime, literally, I'd get run over as they were rushing out for lunch. I'd be like, where are they going? It's like, nobody's inviting me to lunch. However, I didn't, you know, but I'd watch them come back at about 1:30 and they were all, I mean, laughing, giggling, like nothing I've ever seen. And one day I went down and I tracked them down to the pub. They were having like 3 or 4 pints in a lunchtime. Crazy. Answering phones.
You just forget about those days, don't you know?
You really do, yeah.
What was your management style?
Really early on, I think I was really probably mostly about encouraging people to do better and leading from the front. I've always been there's nothing I won't do, I won't ask you to do that I wouldn't do myself. So we were modelling through scripts on the telephone and various things.
So would you describe your drive as being one that was born of a mixture of father relationship,
probably,
and a drive to prove to the world and him, perhaps?
I think it's more about how do you get the best out of people? And I like to think that I'm in the trenches with people. So that's right. There's nothing that I would ask you to do that I wouldn't do myself.
I think that probably comes from your farming background and seeing all of that.
I'm sure that does.
So the tech world is starting to bubble away. Talking 2000.
Absolutely. Yeah, because that's when Y2K.
So are you spotting already? Is Tracy Shercliffe spotting some kind of niche or hole in the market?
So I remember, when I was a good corporate citizen then, I went to the then marketing director of British Gas and I said, oh, we can buy this amazing web URL called gas.co.uk. I think we should buy it. It's currently, I can't even remember what it was, £700. We should buy that. And they were like, I don't think so. Why would you want that? I mean, now I'm like, I should have just bought it myself. I was like, okay. They're not seeing what I'm seeing. So I was there launching, one of the first websites with them. And then from there I moved to Forte Hotels on the Post House brand.
Absolutely.
I mean, unsexy. I wanted the job with Heritage Hotels, which was the Heritage brand. These crappy little hotels off the highways and things for the business traveller. But we did a great job rebranding and revamping those. And we put duvets into hotels. I mean, that was the big drum roll. And it was from Forte that I had the platform to start my first business. It was a content company called Content Generators. So I started a content business. And what I'd done is I'd seen in kind of a demo form, it was called iPix Photography, which was the ability to see a hotel room 360. And I saw that these cameras were available.
So what age were you then?
I was under 30.
What year was that?
That was literally 99.
So it's pre-marriage.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
So does that start to take off, that business?
That does take off.
Okay.
And I got a contract with Forte Hotels. That was the big tick. I left Forte on good terms, but sadly, the reason I left was that I lost a very close friend of mine in a tragic canyoning accident in Interlaken. And it was then that I was like, I have to move. I can't work for somebody else. I have to do something for myself.
So let's fast forward to launching Sonar in 2004, which you then went on to sell in 2014 for a lot of money. What was Sonar and what was the hole in the market, the gap in the market that you saw?
Okay, so I'm going to roll back to this business that I was in, producing websites and content. And in that business, it was really clear we produced an internal platform that we called The Hub, which was around, how you log everything, how you kind of workflow and who's doing what when, timesheet system, billing system. And when I was at that point where I couldn't see that business going any further, I had investors, we were disagreeing. I said, fine, I'm going to leave that business and I'm going to take this piece of software and I'm going to launch a new business. And that was Sonar. So I took a piece of software that I developed in that first business, took that, and then I took it in and I started to commercialise that.
Did you get an investor or were you just growing it yourself?
No, I just bootstrapped it.
Okay, how did you do that?
I literally went out and said, this is the software that we've been using in our agency. Would you like to have a look and use this piece of...
And who are you pitching to?
Other agencies.
Okay.
So anyone who was a couple of people and a dog, I was like, this is going to revolutionise your world. I literally stripped out my flat. The team used to come over in the morning.
How were you paying the wages?
Credit card.
Really?
Literally the credit card.
Really? Talk me through that.
Are you crazy or are you crazy? Because I look back now and I'm like, would I take that
risk?
A lot
of people do. Yeah.
I mean, business was based on a 5-user license, £7,500, 2 days of training. You buy it up front and then you get the license for the year. So we were selling up front and then we were installing and then running out. So it was a subscription that kind of started. I was one of the first people to launch a SaaS software platform because I took that business, which was servers. So we used to ship Mac Minis, which we would configure in my flat, off to people who would plug it in and then They would
but
start
you don't
to use
have
the software.
A background in that industry. So how did you understand?
So I literally...
I know how, because she's bloody smart. That's how.
I saw the opportunity to reproduce what we had been using as a tool. And we kind of coded the outline of it. And then so I got a developer, Nikolai Clark. I don't know where he is now, but he was South African and what a gem, you know. He was just like...
Sounds like you owe him a few quid.
Yeah.
So your pricing strategy talks about scope and pricing for traffic. Is that right?
So literally that business, when I sold it, I kept the rights to all of the data that ran underneath the platform. So we had nearly 1,000 agencies globally. So I ended up opening up London, Sydney and New York.
How are you storing this? I mean, the servers must have been enormous back in those days.
Well, AWS. So in the very beginning, it would be on individual businesses' servers. And I mean, that was probably the hardest thing in the Sonar journey was we changed model from being a server-based business to moving over to a SaaS platform. And in those days, you know, you're talking about a move that happened in kind of 2007. And people, when you said to them, I'm going to put it in the cloud, they're like, what? You're putting it where? So people don't even ask me now. I'm in SaaS software. They don't even ask where it's hosted or what the cloud is. Very rarely. And then you used to get, you know, the 10 degrees.
How many times did you nearly hit the wall?
I just had a shiver down my spine. Lots. Failure isn't an option.
No, it's not.
So, you know, you needs must and you have to keep going.
You could almost argue that continued action with an infallible faith in yourself.
Do you know what I say to people a lot? The worst thing that people can do is indecision. I actually believe it doesn't matter which decision you make, left or right, just make a decision and have the conviction to follow it.
I love that.
And don't second guess it. That's the decision I made. That's the right decision. I'm going. If I look back at my life, could it have been different? Very. But it is what it is. I took the streets, and I just kept moving on.
Do you know, I think there's an absolute pearl of wisdom for the young. If you could just sum it up like that. So many of them don't understand in today's young, just do it and keep going.
I think in 2004, to spot something in the tech world that is going to bring you in, not just buying the software, but bringing you in a monthly income, was incredibly foresightful. I'm thinking back to my hair care lines and stuff like that. You know, if I could get someone to subscribe every month rather than going to Boots to go and buy it, that's what you want, isn't it? Which is 100%. What you saw in 2004.
100%. Well, that first model, we actually had you'd buy it outright and we needed this for cash flow, and then you'd have a 20% fee every year, which was your support fee. We then folded that completely online. I mean, I moved people from a server-based product to an online SaaS product. I mean, that was bloodshed, but I had to do that because otherwise my business wouldn't be acquired. You know, you had to have, I mean, at the stage where we moved over the software from a server-based software over to the SaaS software, we had probably about 300 odd, maybe closer to 400 clients at that point. And in their service contract for this 20% a year, they could have up to 4 iterations. So we would have to log in remotely and update the software on their server machine in their office. Well, with 300 clients and my small team, if everybody wanted even one of those a year, there was no way to do it. Like, we couldn't service that, because it took half a day. So it wasn't even a possibility. So the business had to move.
Did you take on investors at that point?
No.
You managed to do it without any investors?
Luckily enough, the business was at a scale and we were continuing to grow. We'd won awards for the platform. We were Design Week kind of, you know, platform of the year and all sorts of different things.
Were you building businesses with the exit in mind from the beginning?
Yes.
How did you understand that? So few people do. It's so important.
Because I think I looked back at what I'd seen with my dad being stuck in various businesses, and he was growing and trying other businesses with a way to get money. And it was really clear to me that the income that you'd make from a business was around an exit.
The journey you're describing is one that requires massive personal evolution to run alongside the business.
Yeah.
To withstand the pressure. And it sounds like you're quite alone.
I grew up seeing that in my dad. So I guess I thought it was just that normalises it.
When you start something which is quite groundbreaking, what about your IP? How are you stopping other people, firms, ripping you off from coming up with that idea and doing it better than you?
Basic trademarking. So we, even back then, I just researched it on the internet. We took screen grabs that we took and we printed them out. And then we posted them to ourselves with a postmark that is considered to be kind of trademark.
Your industry, because obviously every industry is different, very, very cutthroat.
Back then, there was a lot of competition in the server space, but software and kind of business process engineering wasn't huge like it is now. I mean, it makes sense to me that it was going to be huge.
But it was in America.
It was, absolutely.
Because I was living in Silicon Valley at the time you were doing this.
Absolutely, but yeah. But not for, and remember, I targeted the creative industries. So the creative industries were famous for coming up with great ideas but not being great at business. So we were going in and saying, this is a platform that's going to make you better at your business and help you to make more money, which is why then people went to it. We've got all of this data around pricing. So which is when I took the data that I had from that business and I used it in the current business to create a platform around pricing and how you price better for your business. And in walks AI, which is going
to
upset the apple cart. But I've been doing the current business, Scope Better, for 10 years now. I've been telling people that they need to stop pricing by the hour and that they need to be doing it differently because, I mean, what a silly model. I mean, you know, you're putting a cap on your business because you're selling people and hours. There's only so many people and hours. As you scale, you can't scale exponentially. So the entire Scope Better business is around turning into selling deliverables or outcomes or value, not hours.
You've lost me.
So what happens in the businesses that I deal with, creative businesses, they sell based on the number of hours that they would deliver for a client.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Billable hours.
Yeah. Billable hours. Mm. And so that's capped and limited. Mm. And they would, you know, Rose would get more money per hour than Richard because she was more qualified. Mm. And then they would
better
sell
looking,
it.
Sweetie.
Exactly.
Better looking.
Definitely better looking. I love it. So that's kind of the traditional old model. And how did those businesses get there? Well, somebody in finance decided that the best way to charge for their services was based on an hourly rate. I mean, crazy. So there's only a certain amount of money that you can make in those businesses. When I left the last business, I kept the rights to the data. So I built a data model that said, if you were just going to charge a price for that thing, not made up of the hours that are based on, what would that be? So I started to productize what they'd previously been creating over all of that time
what
with all of that data.
What increase in percentage did you see by doing that?
So what would typically happen is that those businesses were capped in the way that they would be structured or grow. And I thought that people would bite your hand off to be more productized. But businesses don't like change. And they also like the ability to go in and to be able to go, oh, I'm going to charge you 200 hours or 2,000 hours. So the movement of that piece has been quite difficult. The brands wanted to buy the data that I had, but they were going to use it to beat the agencies on the head to make it cheaper. And I didn't want to be a cost cutter. So that wasn't what I was prepared to do. So I've honed the Scope Better business to be around pricing for profitability, which is actually what you should be.
So you're selling the software, basically, that allows them to productize.
Exactly.
Have you found that second business a harder nut to crack than the first?
I thought it was going to be easy, like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah. Pigeons.
Much harder.
Why?
Yeah, shooting pigeons.
In a nutshell,
rabbits.
What?
Rabbits is what we would shoot back on the farm.
Yes. In a nutshell, why?
I think it's because businesses always think that they're profitable, even though that they're not. And how they would perceive profit is that they'd come back to it at the end of the year and see, have I made enough money? I think that was kind of one. I think the other thing was me. I'd made a lot of money. I'd bought myself a yacht. I left my husband, got divorced. So me as a person had changed. And I also decided I didn't want to work that hard.
Yeah. I get that.
And I did. So
I'm really holding back on that. I made a lot of money, so I left my husband. I'm holding back on that.
Well, no, my husband.
It's a natural progression, isn't it?
My husband joined the previous business And I think we did very well together, but that was never my plan. And I think that eroded where we were and certainly how I saw myself. And when you work with somebody that you supposedly love, you can fall out of love with them pretty quickly. And it was just challenging.
I can imagine. So can I ask you, Tracy, what do you think he brought to the table that you didn't? Was he any part of your right arm that you didn't have? Or?
I think so. I think he was British. He was a man. I put him in a position of, I elevated him to a position. I called him the chairman when he first started with me. And I think that was trying to give me what I felt was the difficult thing of being a woman, foreign woman, young, starting a business that I wanted to go global. And I think he gave it a face that seemed like it was more grown up.
Mm.
And I thought from my marketing head that that was a good thing.
Did you do that to counteract the British reaction to women in business?
Possibly. Probably. Almost certainly.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about the money just for a second and sort of creating this incredible business in what was, 2004, you sold it in 2014, in 10 years.
Yeah.
As you're scaling that business, you talked earlier about always having an end goal, an exit.
Mm-hmm.
So you knew what your exit was going to be. Do you only taste the real money when you sell it? Or by that time when you'd sold it, were you cleaning up and you were paying yourself big fat salaries? Or
No.
Is it all being ploughed back in?
No, it was all being ploughed back in.
Because
I was creating this new platform. And yeah, if I had taken a big salary, I don't think we would have had the money to take the jump to move it from a server-based software to a SaaS-based software.
So
I wouldn't pay myself. And it's
really?
Until you sold. And still now. It's like I'm the last one to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, I make sure everyone else gets paid before I get paid. Maybe that is from that farming piece. It's like, let's see where we sit at the end of all of this.
Talk me through. So this is a girl that arrives in 1997 with £80 in her pocket and a backpack. Mm. And then you sell for multi-millions in 2014. What does that feel like?
I mean, bulletproof. It felt amazing.
I bet.
Yeah, it felt absolutely amazing. But it was also one of those things
where... Does it buy you a feeling of freedom?
It does, but I wasn't actually ready to sell at that time. I got a little bit of pressure from my now ex-husband because he could see the writing on the wall and was envisaging a nice retirement. Mm. I'm not the type of person to retire. So I think I probably stopped that journey a little bit early, which is why I went straight into doing another business. And actually, you know, as I said, left or right, never any regrets.
How has making multi-millions affected your love life? Because we know as women that men will struggle with that.
There's also a lot of men that can cope with it.
There's more men that can't.
Yeah, more men that can't.
I have to say, more men that can't.
I think I could cope with it, right?
I mean, I'm very...
Yeah, you could.
I'm very blessed, I think, at the moment. I've got a wonderful boyfriend. I don't know. I think I'd be a lot to take on, I've got to say.
Do you know, I think the hardest thing is for a woman who is an entrepreneur that's built businesses that has been successful to actually stay feminine. Now, you're very feminine, but I think a lot of women end up very much in their masculine self, their masculine energy, partly because the people around them require that of them. But you seem to have found a very good balance with it.
Thank you.
Oh, good. Good, good. I'm glad I was testing if you felt like that.
Yeah.
But has that been something that you have actually, because I think it's quite a unique journey for a female, a woman entrepreneur. I don't think men entrepreneurs experience that dichotomy or that dilemma.
I agree with you. Mm. I completely agree with you.
I actually had a really good relationship with my father, loved him to pieces. But the only aspiration he had for us four girls was to marry the right man. And I thought, sod that. I love men, but...
That's why she's ended up with me.
I mean, that was exactly the same, right?
Yeah.
The aspiration was, you know... Well, in fact, my dad told me that I didn't need to be educated. That was a waste of money.
my father told me that he sent me to school to be a good wife.
How did that work out?
Very well, Tracy.
Ross is right. I mean, what I see sitting in front of me is this extremely feminine woman. So sort of never judge a book by its cover, but you have to have been really tough at times to have achieved what you have, not just one company, but three. Mm. And it feels like that you've done this all alone. Do you ever get bored of being the boss?
Oh, yeah,
I do. You know, it's a lonely place, isn't it?
It is a lonely place.
Yeah.
I am of the ilk, work hard, play hard.
Yeah.
You know, and that's no longer a thing anymore. Like, I realise it's
what is
like,
your version of play hard?
Well, I don't know. I'd probably like to go out.
Have you done a few festivals? Do you still do?
I still do festivals. I still do festivals. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. Do you know I've never been to one?
Richard,
I've actually
need to
never
change
been
that.
To one.
No, I actually haven't either.
I've never been to one.
I've lived a life under a stone.
I've had plenty of good nights out, but I've never been to a festival. Oh, yes, now.
I went to one in the summer called Give, which is a fabulous one.
Yeah.
And, it's a big manor house, and I'm lucky enough to have worked my way from an Airstream now into a room in the manor house. So, you know, there's no camping, there's no...
So, you know, you do Glastonbury, but you do it in a beautiful Winnebago or something like that.
Yeah.
What are your negative sides? What are your faults? What are you not very good at?
And I ask that as an interview question. I find this really quite difficult, but process is one of the things all my businesses and my business successes have been about, showing people how to run process within their businesses. And I love process, but I always think the processes don't apply to me. So I'm the hardest one in the team to get to follow the right process.
Really?
Is that because you're a rebel by nature, or is that because your mind?
I'm definitely a rebel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you ever had therapy?
What type of therapy? I've had marriage counselling, which didn't go very well, of course. We all have.
Terrible.
Yeah, that was a disaster. Yeah.
We've all had marriage counselling. Yeah. We're all divorced. Oh, yeah.
But I have also had therapy with my daughter recently. So
that's very
one
honest.
Of the things that I really struggle with is I didn't have a great relationship and still don't have a great relationship with my mum, which is ironic because I've told you all about the importance of my dad. And it's probably... maybe that's part of it. But one of the things I was really concerned about was the relationship with my daughter. We had several steaming arguments, which were really not great. And ever since, when I got divorced, the children primarily were with me. So that was hard, running a business, two children, getting through schools, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. We had an incident where she said, I'm going to go and live with my dad. And I challenged it and was like, I dare you to. I double dare you, because not one to step down. That is one of those weaknesses in my character. So it was at that point that my daughter said, right, I'm going to go. So we went through a year of counselling together every Wednesday, and it was tough. I'd come out of some of those sessions absolutely just in tears.
Intimacy is about letting people in fully.
We have the human condition. Mm. So there's this thing where you have a kind of a 360 view, where if you have a trait that you've seen somebody else exhibit and it's worked well for them, you have the propensity to do that also. So the way that we invariably behave is learnings through the way that we've seen other people behave, because that's the human condition. So the way that I was treating my daughter was obviously the way that my mother had interacted with me. And that was what was really difficult for me to deal with.
We take into our marriages and our relationships, basically our childhood. I used to think that was a load of nonsense, but it's absolutely true. Yeah. You're a very hard act to follow, though. It's a difficult one, because as a successful person, you think, but I've given you everything that you don't realise that you never had. You know, I didn't have any of that.
What she wanted was just to be told that she was loved. I mean, I got the, you remember that time on my fourth birthday that you forgot to pick me up because you had an important meeting. She was at nursery. I was like, I don't really remember that, but you clearly do. It's, you know, it's there's trauma scars that I have that she has too. So we work through a lot of that.
Yeah, I think the irony is this belief that if you make enough money and then you give it to your children, then they're going to be happy. But of course, happiness is not about possessions or material things.
No.
Happiness is about learning how to be good with yourself. Family is often the casualty of entrepreneurs, and it's why the divorce rate is so high.
On the flip side of that, I think it's easy for a child of a successful entrepreneur to say that.
The most important thing for me was I didn't want to have the relationship with my daughter that I have with my mum. I was like, this is going to end now. So I went to those counselling sessions. I mean, we both at different weeks would end up you know, streaming in tears, which is not my native kind of, you know, not my native modus operandi. It was brutal. I've got to be honest.
I'm sure.
So going back to Sonar, how did you sell that? So you positioned it to sell. What was the process?
It was bought by a company called Deltek, which is an American corporation. We had kind of a meeting internally about 3 years before we exited, and I'd sketched out who could be a possible acquirer, and they were on the list. And then every time we had a pitch or a presentation against them, I'd make sure that I was involved.
Did you have an earnout?
Yes. It was quite a simple earnout, but it was based on me being in the business and then moving clients over and doing certain kind of things for integration.
Because very often, historically, earnouts never reached the earnout or quite the earnout. Did you get the earnout?
Not in the same kind of realm that we were expected to.
Fair enough.
You're going into it where they're expecting something from you and you're expecting something from them.
Mm.
And it's never, you know, it's like that, how my daughter perceived me and how I perceived her.
Mm.
It's two eyes looking at different in different directions.
So what was the exit? It was 3 years for the, what was
no,
the...
No, originally when the first offer came on, they were competing with somebody else. So I got one offer and then I went out and went to kind of look for who would be my other offer. And the interesting thing there is part of what they put in was that they put up that it would be 90 days and then I'd be done, I'd be out.
90 days, that you know.
3 months.
There's no way. Well, they did it in 90 days.
Well, what then happened was just before the deal was about to close, I got a call from their then CEO that said, "Well, I think you're going to be quite instrumental to this, to the acquisition." My immediate thoughts was, "No shit, Sherlock."
Yeah,
I mean, I've grafted this thing from the ground up.
Absolutely.
So I got the ask then to turn the 90 days into 9 months,
right,
which I then said yes. And actually, by the end of 9 months, I was, you know, they'd put me into a position where I was just a figurehead. I wasn't doing what I was doing. I was promising things that I knew that they weren't going to be able to deliver at the same level that I would.
Mm.
So I could see that it wasn't going
to
be.
How can a company prep for an exit? Sorry, I just want to cover this quickly.
That's a really great question. I mean, there's a lot of things that you can do to prep for an exit. Firstly, the documentation is absolutely critical. Document everything around different processes, from banking to better terms and conditions to processes for teams to even small things like ensuring everybody has, it sounds really simple, but ensuring everybody has a performance plan, a job description. Staff is really important when people are acquiring businesses, as is the right agreements for clients and the various different paperwork.
What's it like buying a yacht? Because this isn't just a little
wonderful
dinghy, is it?
No.
This is like a gin palace, I'm assuming.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk me through that.
Yeah, 22.
Let's lighten it up. 22 and talk about
meters.
The yacht. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing because I, you know, you went and you got to spec what was the flooring, what was the drapes, what is the, you know, what's the
fit out.
Was
that on your bucket list?
It was kind of on my bucket list. My dad always had boats and I was like, I'm going to have the mother of all boats.
Where did you keep it?
I kept it in Mallorca.
How lovely. Wow,
yeah,
bloody hell.
Sailed all around the Med.
Did you
took it over to Northern Africa as well.
They always say with a yacht, your best day is when you buy it and your best day is when you sell it.
Oh,
is that true?
I have to say I loved it, but the bills got to the point where it was like, yeah. I mean,
yeah, mooring fees.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, €8,000 to fill it up is just, that's not for the lighthearted when you just go for a whiz around. And you're right. I mean, the mooring fees were $50,000 a year. I mean, it's
wow,
and it doesn't move. That's before it moves.
Last question: you're on death row, and you have one last request. What is your last request?
Oh, to spend the final time with my two children.
Okay.
Tell them how much I love them.
That's a good answer. Actually, that's That is good, because I was going to ask, what's your last meal?
Well, we usually ask the men, but for some reason, she doesn't like to ask the women what's your last meal.
Well, because I don't think the women are so interested in food.
Because most women are going to say, well, I've had enough Jabba Ozempic today, so I don't want to, you know, let it run out.
I've never taken that stuff in my
last meal. My last meal would be my children. Yeah, I'd eat them up.
Tracy Shercliffe, serial tech entrepreneur. Wow, what a woman you are. Thank you so much for coming on Entrepreneurs Worldwide.
Yeah, what a fighter.
Delighted. Roz, Richard, thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Can you do us a favour? Can you hit that follow and subscribe button? You can find us anywhere where you get your podcasts on Entrepreneurs Worldwide. And there'll be a new episode every Wednesday at 5 a.m.